This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 127, War of the Regents. Last time, we left the young Macedonian Empire in chaos. The rebel Greeks were defeated by Craterus and Antipater. The last Achaemenid satrap in Cappadocia was defeated by Perdiccas and Eumenes. Olympias, queen mother to Alexander the Great, and her daughter Cleopatra fled to Sardis to escape Antipater's wrath. Antigonus Monophthalmos fled to Macedon to escape Perdiccas's wrath. The late great Alexander's half-sister Cunane was killed in battle, but ultimately secured a marriage between her daughter Eurydice, warrior princess, and King Philip III Arrhidaeus. The infant king, Alexander IV, was born to Alexander's widow, Roxane. Ptolemy stole Alexander the Great's corpse and fled back to his satrapy in Egypt. And technically, the civil war hasn't even started yet. But it is about to. Perdiccas, officially the regent for Philip and Alexander IV, diverted the royal entourage to Sardis, married Cleopatra, turned the royals over to Olympias's care, and began plotting a war against the four of Alexander the Great's former officers most likely to oppose him: Antipater, Craterus, Antigonus, and Ptolemy. We finished last week's episode with Perdiccas preparing to march south and hunt down Ptolemy in Egypt. Because it's still not the history of Persia without a rushed attempt to fight Egyptian rebels. So, let's get down to it. Perdiccas summoned three primary generals to accompany him as he marched south. At least one of them, Seleucus, was probably traveling with the royal entourage already. After the partition of Babylon, Seleucus was named commander of the Hetairoi cavalry, Macedon's most elite horsemen. The second, Antigonus, was officially the satrap of Susiana, the new Greek name for Elam, the province around Susa. However, he was also the new commander of the Silver Shields, the most elite hypaspists, aka the Royal Infantry Guard. So he too was probably already in Lydia when Perdiccas began plotting. Finally, Phaethon, the satrap of Greater Media, was recalled to join the army after putting down rebels in eastern Iran. We know basically nothing about these rebellions. aside from the Veterans Revolt that we discussed last week, just that they happened. Of the three, Pathon was actually there because Perdiccas did not trust him, and was worried that Pathon may attempt to usurp power in the Upper Satrapies if the Western Empire was embroiled in civil war. So he was dragged along for the ride to keep him in line. While these four went south to invade Egypt, the conspirators in Macedon were preparing to send an army east and invade Anatolia under Craterus's command. So, Perdiccas ordered Eumenes of Cardia, now satrap of Cappadocia, to prepare for battle and prevent Craterus from entering Asia. All of this was made significantly more difficult for both sides, since Lysimachus, the satrap in Thrace, was busy fighting the Thracian king Soothes III, and thus unavailable to pick a side in the civil war or help either army cross his territory. The civil war also distracted from the ongoing Macedonian attempts to conquer Armenia. The Armenian situation at this exact moment in 321 BCE isn't very clear. Alexander had appointed a Persian called Mithrenes to be his satrap there, but depending on the source, Mithrenes might have been the son of the defeated Achaemenid satrap Orontes II, and we never actually hear about Orontes surrendering. The thing that is clear is that by the time the dust settles on this civil war, Mithrenes vanishes and another Orontes is back in control of Armenia, maybe a son or grandson of Orontes II. And Orontes III will have a very different stance on Macedonian rule. Regardless of the details, the reassertion of Orontid power probably has a bit to do with a Macedonian general called Neoptolemos. He left Armenia to become Eumenes' sub-commander in the coming battle against Craterus. They were also joined in command by Perdiccas' brother, Alcestis, Phoenix of Tenedos, a naval commander who played little, if any, role in the wars of Alexander, and Pharnabazus III. This is the same Pharnabazus who served as a massive thorn in the Macedonian side throughout the early stages of Alexander's conquests. He and Memnon of Rhodes directed the initial naval campaign on the Persian side, only to functionally vanish after escaping Macedonian custody. Apparently, he got back into Eumenes' good graces after the mass wedding at Susa, since Eumenes had married his sister. Now, Pharnabazus was serving in one half of the Macedonian army. Unfortunately for the Perdiccan side of the war, the Macedonian navy was relatively small to begin with, further weakened by the Lamian War against Athens, and almost entirely based in Europe thanks to that same war. So they could not realistically hope to go on the offensive or attack Craterus as he crossed the Hellespont. Instead, Eumenes marshaled an army on the southern side of the strait, and on paper had a numerical advantage. Each side had around 20,000 infantry, but the Perdiccan army commanded significantly more cavalry. However, they were not off to a good start. Craterus was commanding an army of veterans, not just of the Lamian War, but many of the 10,000 hardened veterans he brought back from Babylonia. Many of these men had fought their way across the Persian Empire and back again. They were potentially a little annoyed to be returning to Asia, but also, civil wars do tend to motivate people. And before long, Eumenes probably started wishing Neoptolemus had just stayed in Armenia, because the cavalry commander favored the European side of this war and almost immediately took his horsemen and switched sides, fighting an impromptu skirmish against Eumenes' other cavalry on their way out of the camp. When the Battle of the Hellespont came, Eumenes feared that his remaining Macedonian cavalry units would follow in Neoptolemus's footsteps when directed against Craterus. Instead, he left Pharnabazus and Phoenix in charge of the cavalry levied from the local satrapies, and had them charge the enemy as soon as they caught sight of them. Eumenes himself would command the Macedonians on his side against Neoptolemus's cavalry, because they were already seen as traitors. There are two main sources here: Diodorus, the usual staple for this period, and Plutarch's Life of Eumenes. They both focus heavily on the personal deeds of the commanders in this battle. And normally, I am kind of skeptical of any historical report that commanders sought each other out to duel on the battlefield like in a movie. But remember, every Macedonian general of this generation is doing their absolute best to cosplay as Alexander the Great. And Alex had that flair for the dramatic. When Phoenix and Pharnabazus charged at full speed against Craterus, he ordered his own forces to respond in kind, leading a countercharge from the front. But almost as soon as Craterus clashed with the Anatolian cavalry, a Thracian spear killed his horse. Craterus, Alexander the Great's personal choice of regent for Macedon, friend of the late great lord of all Asia, and veteran general of some of history's most famous and brutal battles, fell to the ground pinned underneath his own steed, and was promptly trampled to death by his own horsemen. Even with their general dead, Plutarch reports a hard-fought battle between the infantry on both sides. Typically, ancient spear formations charged and one side choked, either breaking into a retreat or becoming disordered enough for the other side to inflict massive casualties and get that retreat going. We've seen this in almost every battle we've covered. As Plutarch puts it here, the first clash was severe. Spears shattered quickly, and they fought with swords. Ancient spear and pike formations like the Macedonian armies did not like to fight with swords. Those were your side weapons for when something was going horribly wrong. But today, the front line of both armies was composed of veterans of Alexander's wars, and neither had any intention of backing down. Meanwhile, Eumenes and Neoptolemus honed in on one another in the midst of their own cavalry battle, and charged in for a duel. Unlike Persian duels we've seen, both before and during battles, Macedonian horsemen were not javelin throwers. They were lancers. And once their lances were broken in the initial clash, both commanders drew swords to fight on horseback. And when the two came close, Plutarch claims that they grappled, pulling armor and helmets off of one another as they passed in an attempt to pull their opponent out of the saddle. Eventually, he says that they both went down and continued fighting on foot. But Eumenes cut Neoptolemus's hamstring, only for Neoptolemus to prop himself up on one knee and slash at Eumenes' neck. Plutarch's account feels like it skips the pivotal moment in the fight, because both of them seem to end up in the dirt, with Eumenes tearing at the straps of Neoptolemus's armor, and Neoptolemus jamming his sword into the satrap's pelvis before finally succumbing to his own wounds. With their command structure rapidly disintegrating in the vainglorious attempt to emulate Alexander, what was once Craterus's army broke and ran. Eumenes had some of his men hoist him back into the saddle and rode over to witness Craterus's final breaths before going off to have his wounds treated and dictate a report of victory to Perdiccas. According to Diodorus, the initial reports of Eumenes' victory along the Hellespont made Perdiccas even more confident on his march to Egypt. However, he might not have been quite as pleased if he had the full picture. While Perdiccas was marching south through Phoenicia and Eumenes was fighting Craterus, Antipater had also crossed with a small army from Macedon and landed in Cilicia, marching south to catch Perdiccas in a pincer with Ptolemy's Egyptian fortifications on one side and Antipater's advance on the other. By the time Perdiccas found out what was happening, it was too late to turn back. He and his forces had already crossed the Sinai and encamped outside of our favorite gateway to the Nile, Pelusium. Ptolemy had sent large garrisons of both his Macedonian and Egyptian troops to guard every frontier crossing into his satrapy. In an attempt to circumvent these defenses, Perdiccas had his men excavate an old canal that had filled with silt, which would allow them to cross the desert with water and ships to circumvent Pelusium entirely. Unfortunately for the regent, they excavated a little too quickly, and the canal burst in a violent flood that destroyed most of their work and killed the soldiers working on the project. Between this and Antipater's advance, many of Perdiccas's Macedonian soldiers fled to Ptolemy in the night and joined the opposing side. Giving up on Pelusium entirely, Perdiccas took his army south to a less fortified crossing near Tanis called the Camel Fort. Perdiccas did have one tactical advantage here. He had brought Alexander's elephant corps. Using the animals as living siege towers, his infantry charged the fort at dawn and started scaling the walls. Ptolemy himself led part of the garrison from Pelusium south and caught Perdiccas's forces just as they started clambering over the Camel Fort's wall. They continued to assault the fort, but once some of Perdiccas's strength had turned to face Ptolemy, they were losing ground on both sides. The Egyptians regained their footing and began to kill the elephants and knock down the siege ladders, sending a cascade of armored Macedonians directly into the Nile. Ultimately, Perdiccas was forced to abandon this siege as well and return to his camp. He then opted for an unusual tactic, as Egyptian invasions go. Instead of continuing to fight Ptolemy and attempting to push into the Nile Delta, they just marched down the eastern bank of the river almost all the way to Memphis. At one point, they attempted to cross and take control of an undefended island, but for unclear reasons, the current sped up and the water levels increased just after the first wave had crossed. But this washed the next few attempts into the river's depths and left the first wave to drown as they attempted to come back toward the eastern bank. Now, with three drowning disasters piling up, Perdiccas's soldiers had enough. That night, even more men fled north to join Ptolemy, and Phaethon rallied his fellow officers into an outright mutiny against their regent. His role in Alexander's campaigns had earned Phaethon a lot of respect among the troops, regardless of Perdiccas's personal opinions of the man. As commander of the Silver Shields, Antigonus also carried a lot of sway, but Seleucus dealt the death blow. He gathered his cavalry and took them to the command tent at night, where a group of cavalry officers surrounded Perdiccas and gave him the Julius Caesar special. Following the mass stabbing of their regent, the mutineers invited Ptolemy to speak before their assembled forces and end hostilities. Many wanted Ptolemy himself to take command of the empire and become the new regent, but he declined. These calls were probably performative, as a show to hype up the satrap of Egypt's own humility, but it also reflects on the undoubtable fact that Ptolemy, perhaps more than any of the other Macedonian nobles, knew that this was not the end, and that he had a powerful position if he stayed in Egypt. Instead, he declared that Phaethon and Aridaeus, not the king, but the officer who had stolen Alexander's corpse, would be the acting regents. Their first act on learning the full scope of Eumenes' victory in the north was to sentence Alexander the Great's former assistant to death for treason, although Eumenes was still in command of a substantial army. Then they turned on the Perdiccan loyalists in their camp. A brief conflict also broke out between the Greek regions of Aetolia, pro-Perdiccas, and Thessaly, pro-Antipater, But that was too little too late, and a Macedonian army just marched into Aetolia and crushed the revolt. And we will follow the aftermath of this civil war following a short break. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Pathon and Eridaeus were the new regents following the civil war between Antipater and Perdiccas. They went back to Sardis to join their kings, only to find the recently enthroned Queen Eurydice was pulling the strings, and that nobody in or around the royal court would listen to a thing they said if Eurydice contradicted their orders. They needed a more respected leader to counteract the possibility of the royal family actually, you know, governing their empire. Can't have that, not in this monarchy. So Pathon and Aridaeus promptly resigned and suggested making Antipater regent again. All of the leading generals and nobles in the West met at the city of Triparadesos, outside of Sardis, and Antipater threatened Eurydice with accusations of treason unless she backed down. With several prominent governors and generals dead, and the political situation more tenuous than ever, the council at Triparadesos resolved to redistribute the satrapies for a second time in just 2 years. The general thinking now was that Antipater needed powerful but loyal subordinates in the most influential satrapies. For most of the major satrapies, this meant that not much changed. Antipater was still well-liked by the majority of the governors. A few, like Western Syria and Assyria, were shuffled around between more minor commanders that I'll address as they come up. But the big one, the really, really big one, was that Seleucus finally became prominent enough to merit his own territory. And not just any territory. Seleucus was declared the new satrap of Babylonia. This was, hypothetically, a great compromise. Seleucus's role in Perdiccas's defeat could not go unrewarded, but he was minor enough that he could take command of Alexander's own chosen capital without presenting too much of a political threat to Antipater. Antigonus Monophthalmos returned technically to his satrapy in Greater Phrygia, but he had spent the war against Perdiccas hanging back in Macedon with his son Demetrius. Now, they were given the additional role of dealing with Eumenes. Antigonus was declared Strategos of Asia, though this was Asia in the sense of Asia Minor, aka Anatolia. Strategos just means military commander and is usually translated as general, but in this context, Antigonus was more comparable to the old Persian Kerenos, a military viceroy with wide-ranging authority within his assigned region. Antigonus took command of the pro-Antipater army in Anatolia and set out to hunt down Eumenes and the other remaining nobles in the Perdican faction. In spring of 320 BC, Antigonus marched into Cappadocia at the head of a loyalist army 12,000 strong, but Eumenes still commanded twice that. Phoenix of Tenedos ambushed Antigonus's army in the night in a small but demoralizing attack. Antigonus responded by reaching out to another of Eumenes' cavalry officers. So, when Antigonus reached his opponent's camp in the Cappadocian plains, most of Eumenes' cavalry deserted and went over to the Antigonid side, crippling Eumenes' defenses and swelling Antigonus' ranks at the same time. Eumenes fled into western Armenia with just 600 of his remaining followers and took refuge in a fortress called Nora, which Antigonus promptly put under siege. He then turned most of Eumenes' former army that had been left outside the fort and used them to serve Antigonus and the Macedonian regency. Negotiations through the rest of the year went nowhere, so when spring came, Antigonus just left enough men to keep Nora besieged while he marched off to hunt down Alcestis, the late Perdiccas's brother. Alcestis was holed up in Pisidia on the southwest side of Anatolia. So that's where Antigonus went. They marched quickly enough that Alcestis had very little warning before they arrived and was forced to meet the Antigonid army on a small ridge. The phalangites of both sides clashed against one another, neither gaining the upper hand until Antigonus himself directed a cavalry charge at his enemy's infantry, breaking their formation into a retreat. Rather than rest on his laurels, Antigonus directed his army to chase their opponents, with the elephant corps leading the way. I have never been chased by an angry war elephant, but I imagine I'd be glad that Macedonian phalangites don't wear pants. Alcestis and his local Pisidian auxiliaries escaped to a nearby city, but most of his Macedonian forces, including the remaining Perdican officers, were all captured. Unfortunately for Alcestis, when his allies were faced with surrendering him or watching Antigonus burn and pillage their villages, they surrendered Alcestis with only some light skirmishing while they negotiated the terms of surrender. Alcestis refused to go quietly, and the Pisidian officers killed him, turning his corpse over to Antigonus. From there, the Antigonid army marched north to their home base in Phrygia, only to be met on the road by a messenger with dangerous news. Antipater, the aged regent of the empire and one of the last prominent veterans of Philip II's initial Macedonian expansion, was dead at 81 years old. He willed control of the empire to Polypherkon, another older noble who had stayed in Macedon during Alexander the Great's wars. So no sooner had the regency been settled than it shifted. And remember, Antipater had always been the compromise candidate. Polypherkon didn't have the pull to keep things together. Antigonus also wasn't the only Macedonian satrap keeping busy in 320 and 319, although he was the only one with an official edict to prosecute a civil war. Down in Egypt, Ptolemy was looking around, and he saw the writing on the wall. He was looking for weak points in his own borders, any vulnerability to another invasion of Egypt, after lucking out against Perdiccas. Egypt is pretty defensible in its own right, but Ptolemy must have consulted with his local officials for some intel on Egyptian history. They looked northeast across the Sinai Peninsula and thought, you know, Palestine and southern Syria traditionally make a great buffer zone. So the satrap of Egypt mustered his own armies and sent them north under the command of a general named Nicanor. Not expecting an attack of any sort, let alone one from his supposed brother-in-arms, the Macedonian satrap of Syria was captured with barely any fighting, and before long, most of Syria and the Levant fell under Ptolemy's direct control. This left Antigonus and Ptolemy as two obviously ambitious governors with large armies and wealthy territory at their backs when Antipater passed the reins off to Polypharchon in 319. And one man in particular was outraged by this turn of events. Antipater's own son, Cassander, felt the regency ought to be a hereditary position. So Cassander fired off letters to Ptolemy and Antigonus calling for their support in yet another Macedonian civil war, this time against Polypharchon. And both generals jumped at the chance to gain even more power and prestige in the New World Order. With barely a moment to breathe after defeating Perdiccas in the first war of the Diadochoi, Alexander's successors, the second war was already starting. But that will come in the next episode. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.